I've diagnosed a personality disorder and schizophrenia, and you're changing of the tag. So you're trying to confuse us also, right? You're not really Dr. Katz. Okay. I think we should discharge you immediately from the VA. Thank you for being here. Dr. Ira Katz is the Deputy Chief Patient Care Services for Mental Health in the Veterans Health Administration, the Department of Veterans Affairs, accompanied by Ron Allman, Deputy Undersecretary for Vet Benefits, and Paul Hutter, Executive in Charge in the Office of General Counsel. Dr. Katz, you have the floor.
Hello, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I, too, was moved by what I heard from the first panel, as everyone in the room must have been. I want to, before beginning my prepared presentation, comment about the issues that were raised in the last panel. The VA's evaluation, whether it's an evaluation for purposes of treatment planning or compensation and pension evaluation, is a de novo evaluation that's independent and unbiased, evaluating the patient before us and not bound or in any way determined by prior evaluations in DOD. The VA evaluation is patient-centered.
But somebody has to come forward for that, and if they were told, for example, by the Army that they weren't eligible for the VA based on personality, sorry, they may never show up to you, right? You would give them a de novo exam if they showed up, but if they don't show up, you obviously can't do
it. Right, and access is an issue, and we work hard to promote access and to destigmatize mental health to promote access. I want to speak about the issue that was raised in the previous panel, about the fact that multiple diagnoses are the rule, and about how VA applies the principle that PTSD frequently coexists with other mental health conditions. I'd like to request that my written testimony be submitted for the record.
Certainly.
As of the end of the first half of 2007, almost 720,000 servicemen and women have separated from the armed forces after service in Iraq or Afghanistan, and over 250,000 have sought care in VA. About 95,000 received at least a preliminary mental health diagnosis, and among these, PTSD was experienced by about 45,000, or 48% of those with a mental health condition. It's the most common of the mental health conditions, but it's not the whole story, and depression is a close second. The average veteran with a mental health problem received about 1.9 separate diagnoses. Multiple diagnoses, as was suggested, is the rule, not the exception. There can be several reasons for this. First, injuries of the mind, like injuries of the body, can be non-selective, depending upon psychological, physiological, or genetic vulnerabilities. The same stress or trauma could give rise to multiple conditions. It can produce, for example, PTSD and depression, or PTSD or a panic disorder. Second, the disorders can occur sequentially. Some veterans with PTSD may try to treat their own symptoms with alcohol and wind up with a diagnosis related to problem drinking. Third, some pre-existing mental health conditions, like milder personality disorders, could be quite compatible with occupational functioning, even in the military, but they may increase a person's vulnerability to stress-related disorders like PTSD. VA has intensive programs to ensure that mental health problems are recognized, diagnosed, and treated. There's outreach to bring veterans into our system, and once they arrive, there's extensive screening for mental health conditions. Specifically, VA screens all new returning veterans for PTSD, depression, traumatic brain injury, and problem drinking. The prompts for these screens are built into our electronic medical records.
I'm sorry, Dr. Katz, did you say Who does the screening? Did you say? I didn't hear that sentence.
Usually it's the first provider that sees the returning veteran.
No,
usually
was it the VA?
Primary care provider.
I'm sorry. Was it the VA or the military, did you say?
VA definitely screens everyone who comes to us.
Yeah, right, but you see, you didn't say everyone who comes to us
right.
in that sentence. You said every veteran is screened. I want to make, because it's a crucial distinction between every veteran is screened and every veteran who comes to us is screened. Right?
I agree. We
so
work
I want to know
hard,
what you said.
We work hard at outreach to get people
I understand.
To us.
But I bet you haven't gone to those 22,500 and try to get them in and see what's going on with them.
We've gone to almost all of the post-deployment health reassessment sessions to really
Did you call in the 22,500 people who have?
No, sir.
So that's what I would call outreach.
For those who screen positive for mental health conditions, the next step is comprehensive diagnostic and treatment planning evaluation. If someone screens positive for symptoms of PTSD, we're of course interested in whether or not they have PTSD. But we're also interested in whether or not they have depression or panic disorder or problem drinking or other problems. Regardless of the specific diagnosis, we treat the person, not his or her label. Clinical science regarding PTSD has advanced dramatically since Vietnam. There is a firm evidence base for several classes of treatment for PTSD, both medication-based and talk or behavior-based. Specifically, several antidepressants have been found effective and safe for the treatment of PTSD, and many other medications are being studied. Two specific forms of cognitive behavioral therapy, prolonged exposure therapy and cognitive process therapy, appear to be even more effective than medications, and VA is currently developing training programs to make these treatments more available in all of our facilities. In addition, there is increasing evidence for the effectiveness of psychosocial rehabilitation treatments to help veterans with residual symptoms function in their family, community, and on the job, even if they have symptoms left after other treatments. When patients have more than one condition, and most do, clinicians must evaluate the severity of the conditions and the patient's preferences. Plans must allow for combinations or sequences of treatment as appropriate following clinical practice guidelines. VA also employs evidence-based strategies for beginning PTSD and substance abuse treatment simultaneously when they both occur. It may be difficult to diagnose personality disorders in the face of PTSD or other mental health conditions. For veterans with relevant symptoms, the clinical approach in VA is to treat PTSD first. A subsequent step would be to evaluate what symptoms or impairments remain and to plan treatments accordingly. In summary, treatment for PTSD and other mental health conditions can work. For veterans with multiple conditions, there may be a multi-stage process beginning with an evidence-based intervention for the most severe of the patient's conditions. Treatment begins with the most severe and continues until the person recovers and beyond. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. I and my colleagues will be pleased to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Dr. Katz. Colonel Bruce, is it Crow or Crow?
Crow.
Crow. Is Chief of the Department of Behavioral Medicine at the Brooke Army Medical Center and is with us today as the Clinical Psychology Consultant to the Army Surgeon General. We have your written statement, Colonel. If you can... really respond to the first panel as opposed to going through what your guys are doing, so you know all you guys are doing everything right. As Dr. Katz said, he was affected by the first panel. I hope you were, and I'd like you to respond to it in your statement. If you think they're wrong, tell us. If you think they're right, what are we going to do about it?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I actually have an oral statement that's a little bit different, a little bit shorter than my written testimony. I'd like to read that, if I may.
Mr. Chairman, I want to make sure that his written statement is going to be entered right into the record.
All written statements are made a part of the record.
And he does have the opportunity.
He can do whatever he wants. I would ask him to. We put the VA and the DOD as the last panel instead of as the first panel has been the practice here, because after the first panel goes, they all walk out and they don't listen to the citizens and the stakeholders. So now they have had a chance, and I appreciate your sitting through that, to hear. And it seems to me, I mean, if I was in their position, I would want to say, oh, they don't know what they're talking about. We do this, or, yeah, they're right, and here's what we're going to do to fix it. I mean, they have this opportunity, and if they choose to pass it up, well, we'll try to do it out in questions, but I would say that that was not the most responsive way to be. You have the floor, Colonel.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Boyer, who's not here, thank you for the opportunity to address the distinguished members of this committee. I am Colonel Bruce Crowe. I'm the clinical psychology consultant to the Army Surgeon General and chief of the Department of Behavioral Medicine at Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio, Texas. The soldiers of the U.S. Army deserve the very best mental health care available. We know there is a stigma against seeking mental health services in our society and in the military, which is made worse if soldiers don't trust us as mental health providers. The Army has highly qualified psychiatrists, psychologists, and social workers who are in uniform or work as civil service or contract employees. We are helping thousands of soldiers and their family members every day deal with problems of living. We are expected to do our job well and to improve our system when we find problems. Questions have been raised about whether Army psychiatrists and psychologists have been negligent for misdiagnosing soldiers with personality disorder instead of correctly recognizing symptoms of PTSD or traumatic brain injury. This would be wrong and should not happen. The ethics and standards of our professions dictate that our patients receive accurate diagnoses and appropriate treatment. I strongly believe our providers have the best interests of soldiers at heart. Our obligation is to our patients first and above all else. We are committed to reviewing our clinical procedures related to making a diagnosis of personality disorder pursuant to administrative separation under Army regulation. If there are problems with this process, they need to be fixed. The Acting Surgeon General of the Army, Major General Pollack, has initiated a review of the administrative, medical, and mental health records for nearly 300 soldiers who served in combat and were subsequently discharged for a personality disorder. This initial review will include the 295 soldiers separated from the Army in 2006 who had served in Iraq or Afghanistan and had received a separation for personality disorder. There were an additional 791 soldiers discharged for personality disorder who had not served in combat for a total of 1,086 personality disorder separations in 2006. For the period 2001-2006, the Army separated a total of 5,631 soldiers due to a personality disorder. A much smaller portion of that number have served in combat. I may add, I don't think the numbers would tell us whether or not we should be concerned about a problem. One is too many, and we should look to see if there's a problem. This review will be conducted by a team of senior mental health providers looking at compliance with procedures, quality of clinical documentation, and whether there are indicators that these soldiers had conditions that should have been referred for a medical board evaluation. The results of this review will help determine whether additional reviews should be conducted. We expect to have results by early September, with release to the senior Army and DOD leadership and then to Congress. The Army has designed an administrative separation process that is intended to provide checks and balances so that soldiers are treated fairly and correctly. It would be absolutely unacceptable for our mental health providers to participate in any way of a misuse of this process. We have made many improvements to the Army mental health system in the past few years, and we believe we provide the highest quality, most comprehensive, and most responsive mental health care of any military in the world. We know there is more work to do and more to learn about the psychological effects of combat on our soldiers. Every soldier is important to us, especially important are those who need our help dealing with traumatic stress or recovery from a brain injury. We are dedicated to making our system better, and we welcome the opportunity to demonstrate our commitment to the highest quality of psychological care for our deserving warriors and their families.
Thank you, Colonel. I'll start with a question with Mr. Michaud, but I just, given some of the charges that we've heard and some of the history, I would say that it's great that you're doing this review now. It's a little late, but I'm glad you're doing it. I think it should be done by an outside panel, independent panel. I don't trust you to tell me what you all did, because you're going to tell me it's right. We all know that. So why bother? Let's get an outside review. I'm going to try to put that into legislation, because you should not be reviewing these kind of charges that are based on you're going to get the information from the same people who are being charged with negligence. And you're going to ask them, well, was it right? We know what these reviews are. He reviewed the first stack, Surgeon General Pollack did, and everyone was perfectly right. They didn't ask the soldier. They didn't ask anybody else. They just asked the doctor who gave. So why should I trust this review? Mr. Michaud, you're there. You're on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My first question is for Dr. Cates. If you were asked to review someone who a case that someone had a personality disorder to do a thorough and thoughtful review, what would you do in that situation?
The first thing I would do is look for everything else besides the personality disorder. We have effective and safe evidence treatments for many psychiatric disorders. The evidence and effectiveness for treatments of personality disorders is lagging somewhat behind. So as a physician and wishing to help, I'd want to make sure that I've looked for and excluded all other more treatable conditions before making a diagnosis of a personality disorder.
Would you also want to talk to the individual?
Well, that goes without saying. I assumed you were talking about an examination of a patient.
Yeah. Well, there's getting back to the question brought up earlier, where Surgeon General Pollack was asked to do a thorough and thoughtful review, and they never talked to the individual. So that's why I was kind of curious. If you are to do a thorough review, what would the process be? And I agree with your comments. If you were to do one, then you would seem to me you would have to talk with the individual involved. Colonel, the chairman had mentioned about, and you mentioned you're doing a review of the process, and the chairman had mentioned about having an independent review process. In light of everything that's gone on, particularly with Walter Reed, and I've heard my constituents who said that they were asked to be redeployed even though that they had what they thought was PTSD problems, but still they were told that they had to go back over there. What's your thought about having an independent review of this process? Would you object to that?
Well, no, sir, not in general. I mean, if there are questions about the quality of work done by us, and it is more... there would be more confidence in a review by an external group of experts. I don't think fundamentally there would be an objection to that. I think when this idea was conceptualized by our Surgeon General, the idea was this is something that we could do immediately. We have access to the records. But if the level of concern is such that you want to have a high degree of confidence and not in appearance, that is an in-house and potential conflict of interest, I don't think there would be an objection to that.
My next question is, when someone goes into the military, we heard actually in the first panel there's a rigorous process that an individual has to go through. And when you have active duty members then you have the Garden Reserves. What's happening over in Iraq and Afghanistan, what process, or is there a reevaluation for the Garden Reserve members to go through that rigorous process before they're asked to be deployed over in Iraq?
Well, sir, the process was described as rigorous. I would not describe it that way at all. In terms of the initial processing into the military for medical processing, it is basically a self-report questionnaire. And in the psychiatric questions, they really have to do with, is there a history of certain kinds of serious psychiatric conditions, depression, psychiatric hospitalization, suicidal behavior, and so forth. There's not direct...
Colonel, excuse me for interrupting. Did you just say that the Army of the United States of America takes troops into active duty without any rigorous medical evaluation? Is that what you just said?
Sir, there is not rigorous psychological evaluation.
So you're saying rigorous psychological evaluation. Going to one of the, I mean, in a war, in a combat situation, which we know is incredibly difficult and causing of trauma, and you can sit there and say that the Army of the United States of America does not have any rigorous psychological evaluation? That's incredible. I just want to make sure I heard it right. I'm sorry, Mr. Michaud, you still have more time.
Thank you. I guess the distinction, what I'd like to know, Colonel, is where a big portion of the men and women who are fighting over in Iraq and Afghanistan are from the Garden Reserves, and a lot of these folks are up there, and they really haven't had that ongoing military experience for, like, the active duty. So I'm just trying to figure out, since a good portion over in Iraq, is there anything the Department of Army is doing to make sure that before they ship them to Iraq and Afghanistan, that they are able to deal with the issue? And actually, I heard this at the earlier panel that there is a rigorous process, so that's why I mentioned if they had to go through that rigorous process to make sure that they are able to do the job that they have to do.
Sir, I think the way that I would conceptualize it is the presumption is that someone who has enlisted in the Army is able to withstand the duty demands. Once they have cleared the basic training, that they are able to perform in their duty. And unless it's determined otherwise, then the presumption would be that they are fit for duty. We do have two sets of screenings that are directly related to deployment. At the point of redeployment, there is what's called a post-deployment health assessment. So all soldiers who have been to deployment and are returning are asked a series of health questions that do include some questions about psychological functioning. And 90 to 120 days following return from deployment, there's an assessment called a post-deployment health reassessment for all military, Guard, Reserve, as well as active component, that asks about health status as well as more extended questions about psychological functioning that are more sensitive to things like depression and post-traumatic stress.
Ms. Brown?
First of all, I want to thank you all for being here today. And Dr. Katz, if there are this 20-some thousand who have been diagnosed and dismissed by the military with personality disorders, do you know where they are so that they can be helped? Is there any coordination going on now that we know that there may be a problem in the system? Do you know where these people are?
I do not. There's increasing communication and list sharing to match people up. We're very, very good at tracking those who are discharged via a medical evaluation route. those with polytrauma and other related severe injuries, visible or invisible. But those who were discharged via more ambulatory routes are followed primarily through the PDRHA and beginnings of liaison with VA there and by community outreach and education.
PDRHA, tell me what
that
is.
The post-deployment health reassessment okay. that the Colonel was speaking about. These are evaluations that are conducted by DOD with co-participation from VA, primarily vet center staff, usually peer outreach people, to try to make contact.
What about those that DOD has released with a diagnosis of personality disorder? Is there any way that you could reach them? Is there the sharing of the information? In other words, Colonel Crow, if someone is released from DOD with a personality disorder diagnosis, do you ever do follow-up?
No, ma'am. Follow-up of their living situation or
no, where? Follow-up of their mental health needs.
No, ma'am.
And obviously they're not eligible for the VA because they've been discharged because of a prior diagnosis of a prior condition.
No, that's really not the case.
Okay.
They're very much eligible for VA care and benefits. Mr. Ormond, do you want to talk about the benefit side, and I'll talk about care?
Certainly. In fact, I think it's worthy of clarifying that that as long as there is an honorable discharge or general discharge other than anything other than dishonorable conditions, a diagnosis of personality disorder does in no way disqualify a veteran from receipt of disability compensation or VA health care eligibility. We would go through precisely the same evaluation process if a veteran came to us seeking disability compensation for PTSD. We would go through precisely the same process evaluating that claim that we would for any other veteran who came to us with that type of a claim.
Would you yield for 1 second?
As long as the panel isn't going to be attacked.
Okay.
Sir.
Do you know how many people who come to the VA with this PD have come to the VA for help?
No, I do not, Mr. Chairman.
Do we keep that information?
No, we would not, Mr. Chairman. In fact, that information is not even reflected under DD-214. We would have to go through and do actively combed or service medical records and somehow try and capture that information for some future use. And quite frankly, if it's not relevant to a determination of PTSD, we would have no reason to try and collect that information.
Let me ask another question, reclaiming my time. Would a benefits delivery at discharge physical with VA and DOD practitioners evaluate a service member to understand the history and possibly the exacerbation of mental health conditions, new or old?
Do you want to take that, Doctor?
Any reliable and valid evaluation should include those components.
Well, I think I'm asking, do they?
Depends upon what type of conditions have been claimed. Of benefits delivery at discharge, we're going to be conducting the examinations that are going to be relevant to the disabilities that are being claimed as part of that process. For example, if there's been no PTSD or other mental disorder disability that's been claimed, it's unlikely that we would be conducting any extensive mental health examination.
I see that my time is up. Let me ask one other question. Is part of the problem that the young man who testified earlier, Jonathan Town, where he submitted the information multiple times, is part of the problem that the computer system has different programs to it. I know I experienced this when trying to help a constituent and got a very helpful person on the line from VA Disability, and he said, well, I knew the paperwork was there because the constituent sent it in three times. I sent it in once. And he said, well, let me go to this program, let me go to this program, let me go to this program. There were four different programs. So perhaps that was part of the problem, because I know I was being told that constituents' paperwork wasn't there when I knew it was there. He had sent it in several times. My office sent it in registered mail with return receipt. So we knew they had it. Is that part of the problem?
I think in this case, Congresswoman, that's probably the heart and soul of the problem. What you're identifying there is processing shortcomings on VBA's part in this particular case that we're certainly accountable for, but I don't believe it was anything having to do with this particular condition, just probably some sloppy service on our part.
Well, this happened 3.5 years ago, so I'm asking you, have you improve the computer tracking system at all?
Yes.
Tell me how.
The part of the processing changes that have been made have been to upgrade the claims processing system, starting from the very time that a claim is received, Congresswoman. We've not completed that process. It's part of the replacement of the compensation and pension payment and processing system. It's the effort that's called VetsNet. Has maybe a little bit of a troubled history, but I believe that we're on track now for improving that, turning that around, and providing better service to veterans.
Let me ask you one other question. If today an application is made for disability, how many different programs could that information be entered into? It was 3.5 years ago. How many today?
I would say today a receipt of a claim for disability compensation would be entered in no more than two systems, probably only one, but no more than two.
And that is system-wide?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I yield back.
By the way, Specialist Towns applications were not 3.5 years ago. They were far more recent. And he said he had only on the fifth one when he had a lot of publicity did he ever get notice. Let me ask a few questions and make a few observations. The first panel shocked me. You guys shocked me even more. Colonel, you came into my office yesterday to explain to me this wonderful chain teaching approach of PTSD. We're going to educate the whole Army about this. And you said, you know, the whole basis of this chain teaching is that the support has to come from the top, so everybody knows it. And yet, the implication of what you said earlier was that to the Army, psychological stuff is hardly very important. You said there's a high probability they will adapt. We don't have to worry about it. What kind of signal is that sending when, if the physical and the mental, you have no parity whatsoever in your own mind? So how can the soldier ever understand what PTSD is if at the very top you're not understanding these issues?
Well, sir, I could comment about the chain teaching. What we were wanting to describe is that we recognize that stigma for seeking mental health services is a barrier to care.
Did you say anything today that would remove that stigma? You just said, you know, they'll adapt. Real men adapt. Real women adapt. Don't worry about this stuff with, you know, psychological thing. You went through basic training, you're going to be a soldier. That's what you said today. So how does that get rid of the stigma?
Sir, I certainly didn't intend to give that connotation. I think the question had to do with whether there was rigorous.
Yeah, and you dismissed it. You said, we just assume that they're going to adapt to the conditions after basic training. That's what you said. So clearly, it's not important to you, and that's what people get. And if they have something, well, you better not admit it. I mean, I have talked to soldiers and Marines who filled out the questionnaire about, you know, the self thing on entrance, on separation, that they're supposed to talk about any medical conditions. And they told me when they submitted their questionnaire, their commander or their whatever said, you got to redo this. You cannot admit any of this psychological stuff. They'll keep you here another 6 months. You want to go home. Change your questionnaire. We have soldiers getting out of there that are slipping through the cracks that have no evaluation for either brain injury or for PTSD. You are sending back for second and third deployments people who have brain injury and PTSD. I mean, if I was at your position, Dr. Katz or Mr. Elman, and heard what I heard at the beginning, I would have shocked this committee and said, you know, if there are 22,500 people that have been diagnosed, maybe wrongly, according to the testimony, with a personality disorder, let's go find them all. Not just 10, not just 259. Let's go after the 22,000. The Army is a great record keeper, right? We could find them. You say you have outreach. I don't know. I doubt if you're going after. I would take a sample of these, by the way. We have to do this in some legislation. Take a sample of the 22,000, maybe 1,000, and find out what's going on with them. Bring them to the VA. Don't just wait for them to come in. We're responsible for them. We send them into war. We send them into whatever we send them to, whether they're in combat or not. We have an obligation to them. And y'all sit here and say, well, we have outreach, and no, we don't know how many of those personality disorders come in. And Mr. Alman, you said sort of, you know, everybody knows that they could come in and we will do a de novo review. It doesn't have none of what they had before affects us. But if you're a soldier and you were told at age 20 that you're not eligible for VA benefits, as these guys had papers that told them that, and you cannot show up because you had a pre-existing condition, what are the odds that they're going to show up? I think pretty small, although let's find out. Let's go after. Let's take 5% of that 20,000 and find out. Did all 1,000 come in? Maybe you told me you went after 1,000 and they're all now getting adequate treatment at the VA, I wouldn't be talking like this. But I doubt that's the fact. But, you know, prove me wrong. Anyway, given the fact both the military and the VA heard this testimony, which is very, very shocking, that there's a systematic and a policy-driven misdiagnosis of PTSD as personality disorder to get rid of the soldier early, to prevent any expenditures in the future, which were calculated in the billions of dollars, I would take that pretty seriously if I were you guys and say something about that. But, you know, you said you're affected, but nobody said, well, let's go look at those 22,000. Maybe these guys are, you know, they're wrong. We're only basing it on a few people. Well, find out. I mean, it's a pretty serious allegations. And if we had doctors' names, and one was listed, and I have some that have told us that they were misdiagnosing. It seems to me you should go find that out, Colonel Crow. You're just going to look at 300 records and everything will be fine. Maybe there'll be one or two. There's something going on in your organization that is wrong, and it's hurting our young men and women. It has to hurt your effectiveness as a fighting force. I mean, for all I know, we're doing so bad in Iraq because you're sending all these brain-injured kids back to the second deployment. I mean, that could account for how terrible the effort is we're doing. But we got a lot to do here. And if I heard one thing from either organization that you took it seriously and wanted to do something about it, and we're going to ask the Congress to give us the money to go after these 20,000, why don't you ever ask us that? I didn't hear anything like that.
Well, we're grateful for the money we have received, including the supplemental funding.
Nobody asked for that. We asked for it.
And are using them to improve access, capacity, and quality to make VA mental health services.
Well, that's a generalization. I want you to tell me that we're going to look at 1,000 of these 20,000 PD diagnoses, figure out what happened to them, working with the Army, get their names and addresses, go after them. That would show me you cared about access. All this generalization and doesn't tell me anything, because I have people coming into my office every day. And Mr. Brown, Brown-Waite talks about specific soldiers coming in who tell us they can't get, they've called the VA, they think they have PTSD, and they got to wait for 3, 4, 5 weeks to call back. Now, we know people have committed suicide in that interval. But everybody says, oh, we're outreaching, oh, yeah, we have the thing, and soldiers come into our office or call us. They cannot get the help they need. They're dissuaded from coming in or, when they come in, they get there's a limit to the number of sessions they can have, and on and on. So something is wrong.
We'll take your suggestion for these specific outreach and follow-up studies and work to do them.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, ma'am.
First of all, I have not told you people came into my office on PTSD issues.
You've talked about specific
cases. I have talked
cases.
About specific cases, yes, including one this morning. I just wanted the record to be made clear. And I think that perhaps the record may not also be clear about the conversation with Colonel Crow. That's not the testimony that he gave here today. It may have been what he said in your office, but your assessment of his saying, oh, they'll be all right, that was not the testimony that he gave here today.
If you read the transcript of his testimony, he said, and we can take down his words and see it right now, but we won't, that he said, when asked about the rigorous examination, and I said, you mean you don't have a rigorous examination? He said, well, I was speaking mainly of the psychological. And then in answer to a question from Mr. Michaud, he said that something to, you know, not exactly quoting, but something to the effect is, we assume that they will adjust after basic training to the war situation, right? I mean, that's what I heard. Is that what you heard or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, we'd have to look at the record because I couldn't hear.
And besides, if he said completely different words, and that's what this poor little congressman heard, and he's not communicating right, and we gave him a chance to change it. But he gave the impression, and I'm sure it's in the transcript, that the psychological evaluation was not as rigorous and was not as important because a real soldier will adjust. And that's the whole problem we have. That's why these people in panel one came to us, because we don't have an understanding of these issues, and we don't have treatment of them, and we have a systematic effort, apparently, to try to get rid of them without having more problems. They don't follow them. They took them into the Army. Seems to me we have some obligation there, and we don't follow them up or anything. They're back who knows where. So I hope that we can look at some of those PD evaluations. Thank you, Dr. Katz, for saying that. And we're going to the Surgeon General will ask for an independent evaluation, or we'll put it in legislation. But if you think that we're going to believe an evaluation of 259 cases, whichever ones you happen to pick, or the ones that had combat, I guess, and we're going to believe what you say? I'll tell you now, I'm not going to believe it. So why bother? Let's have an independent evaluation, and we'll try to deal with that. Mr. Michaud?
I would have two quick questions, but I don't know if Mr. Rodriguez had any questions.
Somebody should start.
My two quick questions, actually, one for Dr. Katz is, you talk about taking care of our veterans. A quick question. What do you do with someone who is a veteran who's employed by a company like Blackwater, who's currently over in Iraq and Afghanistan, but they might be a priority 8 veteran, but they need help with traumatic brain injury or PTSD? Would you take that individual into the VA system? And I don't need an answer today if you don't have... So that would be my question for them. The additional follow-up question to the colonel would be, you had mentioned earlier that every soldier is important to you. Some of the concerns that I've heard from men and women who've been over in Iraq, who've come back from Iraq, when you look at the ratings, if everyone's really important, when you look at how you deal with the disability ratings, it's different than the VA. You look at the injury, as I understand it, whereas the VA looks at an individual as a human being, as a whole person, and that's why we're seeing a disparity in ratings. And when you are reviewing this process, hopefully that you would look at the soldier as an individual, and yes, they might have lost a limb over in Iraq, but yes, they also might have caused other problems such as PTSD or TBI. So hopefully that review process will look at an individual as a whole person, similar to what the VA does.
We will respond to the question about the veteran/contractor for the record.
Mr. Rodriguez, do you have a concluding comment or question?
Okay. I hadn't had a chance to.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize for missing you. I'm sorry.
And I apologize. I didn't get a chance to listen to the panel either, to the whole panel, although I know Dr. Katz well, you know, so good seeing you again. I don't know how many of you actually listened to the initial testimony. As we look at the numbers of 22,000, I would presume, and I want you just to comment on it, that that's a pretty significant, kind of disproportional in terms of the diagnosis for that specific diagnosis. Would that be accurate in saying that's, you know, if there are 22,000?
I'm sorry, there have been 720,000 individuals discharged or separated from the military after service in Iraq and Afghanistan.
760,000.
Okay. 250,000 have come to the VA.
So 22,000, you know, usually there's a percentage out there, for, you know, like, I guess 0.5% or a percent, you know, of the population falls into schizophrenia. What other percentages? So is that something that's, that's out of the outer?
How many of those 250,000 were diagnosed by the VA with personality disorder?
I could get back to you about that. That's not one of the diagnoses we follow most closely.
Yeah, I was just wondering
if you're not looking for it. You told us you're looking for PTSD. They're
and
looking
depression.
For personalities.
Yeah, because I think I was just wondering whether there's a disproportionate number in that population of that specific diagnosis. That's the only reason I was asking. Secondly, if we know that when you know, and it also brings some concerns, and I know the colonel, and I'm familiar with BAMC, that do great work there. Do we know in terms of the data that we have now if there's a disproportional maybe coming out of Fort Carson or other areas with that diagnosis, or do we know that for a fact, or we don't have that information?
No, sir, you're raising some very good questions in terms of prevalence rates of the diagnosis, let's say, of personality disorders in general. How have they varied or stayed constant over time, before war, after war, mm-hmm. given the different demographics of the soldiers that are coming in? There would be a lot of questions, I think, that could help answer whether or not there seems to be a variance at this point in time with making that diagnosis.
To see if there's a pattern, that, you know, maybe from some areas or some psychiatrists doing, going in that direction versus others, you know, in terms of their decision-making. I would also be concerned if, and you mentioned it also, if there's one that we've misdiagnosed as one too many. And so of the ones that we have dishonorably discharged, and I don't know if we have those figures, if it were due to self-medication, because I know that sometimes when they are, you know, ill, there's a tendency to self-medicate and maybe get illegal drugs. And I know that that's grounds for, you know, dishonorable discharge. And I'm curious now whether there are some people under that category that could have been ill and were not caught and now find themselves, you know, dishonorably discharged as a result of trying to self-medicate. Do we have any idea?
No, sir, I'm not thinking of a way that we would be able to answer that.
We'd have to go after the discharge that were dishonorably discharged to get a grasp to see if there's any, you know, because if we've made mistakes in diagnosing, you know, and I know, you know, full well that that someone may be seriously ill, and we misdiagnosed, then we could have also, that person could easily have gone to try to self-medicate, you know, in the process of doing that, and then find themselves, even though they might have had a great record with the military, find themselves dishonorably discharged as a result of that. And so I would be concerned if there's just one, you know, who deserves to, you know, have not to have, you know, fallen into that category. You know, I wonder if you had any comments on that. Have we ever done any assessments of that?
We have seen the press reports about that happening and are very concerned about those tragedies. Mm-hmm. There are processes in VA for appealing less than honorable discharges to reclaim eligibility for benefits, but they're cumbersome.
The chairman said, you know, we're in a situation, and we hear that report. I guess the frustration is if we don't hear anything, we're going to come up with a plan as to what's best to get to the kind of to get to it. And unless we hear, you know, that and the report tells us that other than no, everything was above board. But if not, you know, what would you recommend under those under these circumstances, having heard, you know, the allegations?
Well, sir, I think if the question is the Army and perhaps the other military services doing an accurate job of diagnosing personality disorders as they are administratively separated, I think there would be some other indicators that we could look at. One of the things that I had mentioned in my oral statement was there is supposed to be checks and balances in this process, and one of the balances, if you will, is a review by a legal officer to make sure that procedures were followed, that the soldier who's being separated understands the nature of the separation, agrees with it, understands their benefits. That's not a medical procedure. I don't know if there are suspicions of problems with that balance part of the problem, maybe complaints by soldiers that it's not working well. I really wouldn't know that, but I think that would be another potential indicator.
Yeah, and because I know that that particular diagnosis, you know, almost kind of automatically, you know, disqualifies some, you know, personality disorder, basically indicating that it would. Now, the other diagnosis of schizophrenia, we haven't heard anything on that, but that's onset's also early adult, and it's under pressure that it reveals itself. Do we have any data on those individuals?
Among those who have come to VA for clinical care, among the 250,000, the number of those who have served in OIF or OEF who have come back with a psychosis is really quite small, under 2,000.
Yeah, and in the regular population, that is about 1% or less. So, you know, that seems, I don't know what the numbers are. So is that about appropriate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. And you know,
thank you. Do you have any final thoughts, Ms. Brownlee?
Mr. Chairman, I would ask that the record be reflected for the true statement that Colonel Crowe made. I just want to make sure that there's no misinformation out there. I just think that that would be appropriate.
This is officially transcribed, so all his words will be in the record, as will mine.
I just wish that there could be some way that your words and your interpretation it could be indicated that, because I think that there was a very clever weaving of what he said and how you interpreted it. And that concerns me.
Well, thank you for saying I'm so clever. But Mr. Kennedy, do you have any final
clever.
Thought?
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to point out once again, as a member of the Veterans Appropriations Committee, that, you know, we're looking forward to going to conference committee and looking to address the immediate. You know, we're talking all about these problems, but we've got all these veterans out there suffering right now, and we've got to get help to them right away. It's a lot of talk going on, but we need action. And we need to make sure that we get these services out to them ASAP without delay, and we need to do it this year post-haste, and I hope in this conference committee that we can take this authorizing language that this committee has been working on the contracting out and set aside dollars for the VISNs to specifically use to contract out for mental health services and other services with local community health providers to obtain the services desperately needed by these veterans that they're not now currently getting by dint of the fact that the need is so great and the capacity is so limited within the VA. And the intransigence, it seems as though, that there is within the VA to want to share, to go outside itself to, I know there's this insular attitude. I don't know if any of you could talk to me about where that comes from. I know it's kind of sacred cow. I hear it from my VSOs. They don't even want to hear me talk about any contracting out of VA services because, God forbid, anything but the VA provide services to my veterans. But I'm telling you this, my veterans don't care where they're getting their services now. That World War II generation wanted to be with World War II generation. Korea wanted to be with Korean generation. But after that, these new veterans, they don't care where they get their care. They want their care. Okay? And they don't care if they're with their fellow veterans. They want to make sure they get their care. I just assume we take a gold card and give it to every vet that comes back and say, you go out there and you get your care. This notion that we're now trying to protect these sacred cows so as to, and in the process, letting our poor veterans go out there and in the middle of all of this, have to wait in line and, fight for what should truly already be theirs to me is just something that's inexplicable to me. But maybe you guys could shed some light on this issue to me. You understand the issue that I think we all do, that there is a cohort of veterans from an earlier age that all love to be together because of that sense of common experience, that there is that bonding. They like to be together. But there's a new generation of veteran that, frankly, wants to just get their health care, get their benefits, and get on with their lives, that isn't as consumed with this notion that where they get it, they just want to get their health care. And maybe you can answer me why there's such this sacred cow about we can't get these VISNs to give up the sacred territory about contracting out with community mental health providers, per se.
Yeah. Mr. Kennedy, I'd like to respond by saying I've admired your advocacy, knowledge, and passion for the mental health issues for many, many years. All of us in the mental health professionals are very, very glad you're here. I think that what we're protective and paternal about isn't our turf, but the quality of care as well as access to care. And we would very much appreciate the chance for technical discussion with you about how to optimize both access and the quality of care.
Well, let's work on the appropriate language. But one thing I think that would be a conflict is if a local vision director has to make a choice of deciding where to put the money, and they're going to take that budget, and that budget is going to be chosen as to whether they're going to take their money out of their own hide and spend it on a community mental health center or not. Where are they going to spend it? They're going to spend it within their own budget to make ends meet, as opposed to take a chance at looking at this local community health center that does great work down the way. Now, that local community health center has certified mental health professionals. Now, frankly, the experience of these veterans run the gamut. Now, granted, you have the post-traumatic stress disorder, and the VA has certain expertise. And in fact, we're studying some of that in my district. That's some of the most cutting edge in the PTSD area. But there's a great deal of work in substance abuse, in marital counseling, in a whole host of areas that, frankly, there's plenty of room where the VA doesn't need to be, where they can be maximizing the use of these mental health professionals. When you've got over 40% of the Guard and Reservists right now suffering from PTSD, I would think that you would err on the side of caution of getting them access to some kind of mental health professional rather than saying, hey, we want to be perfect to be the enemy of the good. I don't think we want the perfect to be the enemy of the good, because frankly, even if a mental health provider is not an expert in PTSD, it doesn't mean that they don't have the kind of training that they need to deal with trauma, because trauma itself is not something that they aren't ill-equipped to deal with in general. So let's work together on this, because I think it is something with the magnitude of this problem, we can't wait. We both agree that waiting is not the answer. Failure, is not a solution, as they said in Apollo 13, because we know that delay here makes this problem worse, not better. And I thank you for the work that you do. You are concerned about this, and maybe I could ask. One of the problems that my local VA hospital said to me is that if not asked about whether an Army, a Guard reservist was being treated for PTSD, they would be called back up. That was specific to my VA in Providence. My PTSD supervising doctors told me that they saw some of their patients being sent back to Iraq. And as a matter of policy, the Navy specifically prohibited, but the Army did not. They said that the Army, if they did not specifically ask whether they were treating someone for PTSD, that the VA did not have to volunteer that information. Is that true?
VA's policy is to share information without significant barriers for those with whom we share clinical care. The redeployment decision is a command authority administrative decision, and VA's policy on sharing clinical information for administrative command authority reasons is to require that the veteran consent to VA sending the information to DOD. We're concerned that there may be cases for whom that exposes veterans to risk,
but we're concerned that without a consent provision, we may not be recognizing the rights of people who may want a military career and respond to treatment to continue their military careers. It's a tough tightrope in balancing rights and responsibilities.
Well, it's what it seems to me is they're concerned that they can't say that I am getting treatment because they know the military is going to say goodbye and their military career is going to be over. Whereas if they said, no, I'm getting treatment, the military would say, okay, you can stay in the military, but here are some other options for you in the military. That is what I think that is the missing piece here. Mm-hmm. Instead, what we have is we have the military saying, you know, don't ask, don't tell. And in the process, we may have someone who comes back into the unit that may be a threat to the unit if they're not safe to themselves and to the unit. I mean, you've basically said if they are not you're balancing on the one hand the individual's needs with the unit's needs, correct? So how do you do that?
Well, VA's policy is to provide this information to DOD with the veteran's consent, and our assumption is that the Department of Defense examines people about to be redeployed for mental health and other physical conditions that could limit their effectiveness.
Right. Well, the thing is, my PTSD doc in Rhode Island said that he was actively treating PTSD guard and reservists who were on medical leave, reservists. Okay, so that they were called up again, and he wasn't consulted as to whether that they should be called back into active service, and so they went back to Iraq, and presumably they joined their unit, and presumably they were fit to join their unit, and they weren't a threat to the security of the unit or themselves. But it is interesting that that fine point has not been worked out. I believe in protecting the private confidentiality of the soldier, but I also believe in the safety of the unit, and I don't think that in order to protect the privacy of the soldier, we need to sacrifice the safety of the unit, and I don't believe that the soldier's future career needs to be jeopardized. I think that there ought to be other options for that soldier to pursue. That's the big conundrum, is there's this notion that if they reveal that somehow they've been sought treatment, that they somehow have no other, their options are limited, absolutely limited from there on, which of course, as we know, is not true. So that I think is this where the stigma comes in.
I'd like to make a comment. I'm not sure that will really address what you're saying, but I think the assumption has been made throughout the course of the day that once diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, it's sort of a end-of-the-line kind
right.
of connotation, and that's not the case as we see it.
Right.
What we know is we have soldiers who are diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder who continue to do their job. They want to do their job. They want
right.
to stay on active duty and perform. So there's not an automatic disability associated with post-traumatic stress disorder. We also know that the models of treatment that have been developed came from a different population at a time when we didn't know very much about PTSD. And we believe that it's extremely important to rapidly develop, to the extent that we can, models of treatment that allow us to provide interventions close to the time that the traumatic event and the symptoms appear. That is not a situation that we had in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
It's a situation that we do have now. It's an opportunity. However, the professions and the science had not matured to the point where we have off-the-shelf capability to do that. That does need to be developed. We're extremely grateful that there has been a considerable sum of money that will be provided to Department of Defense to help both with research as well as new clinical programs that I think will help quite a bit. I also think it would be remiss to leave the impression that the mental health providers in the Army or Department of Defense don't know what they're doing. We have extremely well-qualified and extremely well-trained individuals. If there are problems with individuals who are outside the variance of clinical practice, by all means, that needs to be corrected. But we have dedicated professionals. We have strong ethics within the Army of taking care of soldiers and trying to do what's right. And I think that needs to be recognized and not overlooked.
Thank you. Thank you, Colonel Crowe.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, we don't have enough of them.
That is true.
We don't have enough of them. And we also have had a ethic of pull yourself up by your bootstraps, too much of that ethic recently from the political establishment in this town as of the last few years, that believe in God and country and you'll make it through. And that, my friends, has been what's been wrong with this. That if you believe in God and country, you'll be all right. If you don't, that's, you've got some moral deficiency here. That's what we got to get over. This is a real disease, a real effect of war, and it's not some moral failing of the person and not some character defect. And unfortunately, so much of the there's been so many mixed messages coming from political leadership at the VA and from the administration, whether it be other administrative Justice Department through the politicalization of those other departments and so forth, that has sent these messages out that I think is what's made it very difficult for people who have been trying to seek care to go out there and think that it's all right for them to seek care. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. Thank you for your leadership on this. We thank the panel for being here, and this meeting is adjourned.